Legal Face-Off on WGNRadio.com is brought to you by McCorkle Litigation Services, leaders in court reporting and legal technology.
Hey, what's up, y'all? It's your man Montel Jordan, and this is how we do it. And right now, you're listening to Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. That's right, you're locked onto the high-energy legal podcast with lawyers Rich Lenkov and Tina Martini, and they're going to be trading jabs on the breaking news and the hottest issues, sports, entertainment, politics, nothing is off limits. Keep listening, because this is how we do it.
Welcome to another edition of Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. Of course, we have Tina Martini of McDermott, Will, and Schulte, and Rich Lenkov from Downey Lenkov. I'm your moderator, Jack Heinrich, filling in for Ryan Burrow. The Trump administration is exploring bold and controversial strategy, deporting convicted foreign criminals not back to their home countries, but to African nations like South Sudan and others, even though those deportees have no ties there. The approach enabled the recent Supreme Court ruling has triggered strong criticism over legal ambiguity. To provide some insight on this topic, we are joined by David Super, a professor of law and economics at Georgetown Law. His research focuses on administrative law, constitutional law, legislation, local government law, and public welfare. Professor Super, thanks for coming on with us.
Thanks for having me.
Professor, as Jack mentioned, over the past few months, the Trump administration has been deporting convicted foreign criminals to various countries, including in Central and South America, and now Africa, with many being removed to countries that are not their place of origin, known as third countries. Is this process legal?
In many instances, it is not. Congress has placed strict limits on the ability to deport people to third countries. There are some flexibility if the immigrant has some ties to that country, but in no case can they deport someone to a country where the person would be at risk of incarceration or death because of their political beliefs, national origin, or race.
What's the remedy, though, for the migrants? And is it practical for them to really challenge the deportation, given the dramatic difference in resources, of course, right? A lot of these migrants are inherently, they don't have the resources to hire a lawyer. I know there's a lot of public aid available. A lot of lawyers will be rallying for them. But what do you think of the potential challenges to this deportation?
Well, the ability of individuals to challenge these cases is a big problem. There are a lot of lawyers that have stepped up in these cases, but the sheer volume that the administration is pursuing swamps any available resources. That's why a class action was filed to try to provide for more regular procedures. A lower court issued an injunction, but the Supreme Court stayed that injunction, and we don't really know why.
So that actually leads into my next question, which is, what kind of case law, what kind of approaches have we seen in the courts, particularly the Supreme Court, in terms of addressing these legal challenges? And what kind of precedents do you think have been established that are likely to stick in the area of these deportations?
Well, the Supreme Court has been acting on emergency petitions rather than fully argued cases. So we don't have a lot of opinions, and lawyers and judges are trying to connect the dots on these various orders, but that's not easy. We know from the Supreme Court's action in the Alien Enemies case that people need to be given a reasonable time and reasonable notice to challenge these removals and an opportunity to file a petition for habeas corpus to be freed from what's being done to them in a timely manner wherever they're being held. That the court apparently was unanimous on, but the court did freeze this injunction that tried to provide detailed procedures that was issued by the court in Massachusetts. So we know there need to be procedures, but we know the Supreme Court was at least anxious about the particular procedures in that case. Beyond, we don't know a great deal.
How does the 14th Amendment play in here, Professor? Because the 14th Amendment guarantees that anyone born in the U.S. is a U.S. citizen. Wasn't it designed to specifically prevent this kind of back to Africa movement or threat?
Well, there's a separate question about whether the people who are being removed are U.S. citizens. That has come up in some instances. It will come up in many more if the president has his way with his executive order trying to curtail those 14th Amendment rights. There certainly have been cases where there have been contests about whether someone is or is not a U.S. citizen. The 14th Amendment also, and the Fifth Amendment, require that people be given due process before they're deprived of life, liberty, and property. Being sent to a country you have no ties with is pretty obviously a deprivation of liberty. And in the case of a country on the brink of civil war like South Sudan, it may be a deprivation of life as well.
And to be clear, you know, at least it's hard to track all of the Trump threats, right? Let's be honest. But to be clear, this, you know, this threat is to deport non-U.S. citizens, although he has mentioned very clearly that one of his ideas is to also possibly deport U.S. citizens. And he's said things like the worst of the worst. Who knows what that means? That certainly would be prohibited by the 14th Amendment. Whether non-U.S. citizens could be deported to Africa is a different question. And that would involve the language of, you know, subject to the jurisdiction thereof under the 14th Amendment. But again, Trump has made, you know, has talked about deporting even citizens overseas, right?
He has. He talks about the worst of the worst when he says that. But on other occasions, he suggested that you can be the worst of the worst and never be convicted of any crime.
Yeah. Hard to track that.
It's very possible that by coming on this podcast that we are all the worst of the worst.
Professor, I have one last question. What are the incentives that we're seeing for host countries to accept these deportations, and what's the backlash been?
Well, this has been kept very hush-hush. We know, because the president of El Salvador bragged about it, that they were paid, I believe, $6 million to hold people. We assume that other cash payments or tariff concessions or other deals of one kind or another, perhaps arms sales, are being offered to additional countries that are taking people in. With a country as unstable as South Sudan, I shudder to think what we may be offering one faction there against another. But this has been completely lacking in transparency. And the kinds of countries that we've been making deals with, like Eswatini, El Salvador, and South Sudan, are countries with terrible human rights records where people have a very legitimate fear of violence or death if they should be sent there.
No, it's, I guess my last question is, it's ironic that this is a Trump plan when, you know, very famously he referred to a lot of third world countries as, you know, S-hole countries, right? So now, when he feels that is advantageous to use that as, you know, a political tool, he is sending people back to those countries.
Well, he doesn't have much respect for the immigrants either. He's publicly told a great many lies about them, such as the ones in Springfield, Ohio. So I think he's quite comfortable sending people he doesn't like to countries he doesn't like.
Professor David Super, thanks so much for joining us on Legal Face-Off.
My pleasure.
You are listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Dina is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers & Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crane Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and she frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. McDermott, Will & Emery is an integrated international law firm. McDermott has an uncompromising commitment to legal excellence, extraordinary client service, and a high-performance culture. It is committed to helping clients achieve stellar legal and business results today and well into the future. To contact Tina and to learn more about McDermott, Will & Emery, visit MWE.com.
In 2016, Pittsburgh dentist Larry Rudolph's wife, Bianca, died from a supposed self-inflicted shotgun wound during safari in Zambia. Here with us is Ian Wallach, an experienced trial attorney with a background in both public defense and private practice. He has worked on a range of state and federal criminal cases, along with international legal matters, including representation of three Guantanamo Bay detainees in alliance with the Center for Constitutional Rights. He joins us to unpack this international investigation and comment on the documentary about it. Ian, thanks for joining us.
A pleasure.
So, Ian, as Jack mentioned, the documentary, it's the name of it is Trophy Wife Murder on Safari, tells the story of Larry Rudolph and his wife, Bianca, who was shot to death while the couple were on safari in Zambia back in 2016. He claimed that it was a self-inflicted wound, but ultimately he was convicted of her murder. And this new documentary on Hulu tells the story. Tell us more about this case and this documentary.
Well, let me begin with the documentary. When you go to a documentary, frequently you're going for information. You want to be given different options. You want to be able to make your own choice as to what happened. I really perceive this as a fun, entertaining narrative. It was a story. It was clearly the director's opinion right off the bat and the editor's opinion that Rudolph was guilty, that he had killed his wife. I mean, the very first shot, it says 8 years before the murder. So clearly the director and the editor are not questioning whether or not it was a murder. And that, and the whole documentary seemed to be a very entertaining, colorful story about a horrible man who definitely killed his wife. And I'm not sure that if I was the lawyer on the case or had exposure to different facts, that's where I'd end up. So I would consider it more of a movie than a documentary, even though it certainly had that format.
Okay, what about the mistress? What was her involvement? Because his dental hygienist was his mistress for many years leading up to the death. What role was she depicted in the film, and is that accurate?
I think it's accurate to say that they were having an affair. Role in the death, I don't know if she wasn't even accused of being a participant or someone with knowledge before it happened. She was charged with accessory after the fact later. And that's sort of weird. Normally that's like, you know, you take a body, you put it in a car or you hide it, or you tell the officers that someone who did something is not in your house. In this case, and I think it's a stretch and we'll see what happens over time, is they claim that her testimony to the grand jury when they were investigating him was false, and that conceptually was making her an accessory after the fact. I don't really see that works. Basically, she was accused of a crime that a lot of people don't know is a crime, and a very serious crime, which is lying to a federal officer. Oddly, we can usually, unless you're in custody, no one knows this. It's okay to lie to state police. There's rarely no law against that. And while I don't recommend it, I certainly recommend it more than talking to them, which almost always goes poorly. But this is it's a serious crime, and she got what I thought was an offensively ridiculous sentence for it, a sentence of 17 years, which may have indicated that the judge believed she had more culpability in the actual murder than the crime he was charged for. And I can talk about this more. She did make a terrible, terrible mistake during her criminal trial proceedings that led to that ridiculous result. But that is a ridiculous result. We're talking about a crime that generates astronomically less time on a normal basis. So that was pretty brutal. She had an affair. The guy she's been in love with for years, she moved in with immediately right after his wife died. Not a smart move, not a good look. They were together. Apparently they talked about this killing that's questionable out in public. They began to hang out in public. It was, imagine if you knew the family, if you knew Bianca, that's a hard pill to swallow. You know somebody, she goes on a trip, she dies, she comes back, and immediately her husband, who's a unique individual, is with someone else who you suspected they were with before. That's a hard pill to swallow. And I imagine a very damaging one to present to the jury.
So Ian, in that vein, you know, there's a lot that's been discussed and written, and obviously there's this documentary about this murder, that the tide was really going in his favor, especially as a circumstantial case. But then there's this specific evidence that really made the FBI suspect that Bianca Rudolph was murdered rather than a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Walk us through what that looked like.
So the specific evidence was unique because, you know, evidence, it comes in lots of different forms. It can be things that you see. It can be things that people say. And in this case, it was what people said. People began calling the FBI and telling the FBI, oh, it's got to be a murder. He said this to me, or I've always known he was going to kill her, or They were out in public here. And these types of tips, what the FBI agent said was, normally we get these with great frequency, but never are they uttered with particularity. And in this case, there was a certain specificity, a certain type of particularity that made them raise concern and commence an investigation 3 or 4 years after the shooting, which is unusual. There's also this one bit of really crucial evidence that was presented as devastating in the documentary, but I think it definitely warrants further exploration, where a bartender purportedly heard Rudolph say to Lori, "I killed my wife for you," scream, "I killed my wife for you." And that was absolutely devastating. He said it was an immediate break of the music. Now, I do find that strange, and I don't know how it was explored at trial. You know, our memories are drastically impacted by the questions we are asked or the information that we have. So I don't know if that guy was working there and people said, "Oh, that guy might have killed his wife," and then he hears it, in which case it's terribly important. I have a hard time believing that this guy heard the statement in an abstract by a customer who's very well tipping and immediately calls the FBI and says, I heard this terrible thing. I have no other information. I think that's a long shot. And we don't know what the background information was on that very, very damning testimony. I will say, even though I wasn't there, I don't think that's what did him in. I can tell you my guess. My guess is, without a doubt, this man was a man who liked to be on TV. He liked to give attention. Now, his lawyer is just phenomenal. He's the vice chair of an amicus committee for the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. That committee generates more briefs that are read by the Supreme Court than any organization in the country. He's Harvard educated. He's great. But you don't know what's going to happen at trial, and you don't know who's really running the show. And the client, theoretically, the lawyer's supposed to have control over everything, with the exception of whether you go to trial and whether the client testifies. And he might not have had a choice. It does look like, according to the interviews with the juror, what he felt like, that they were in the lead when the government rested. But they were in the lead. And that a lot of people would have tried to find a way to stop there. And it doesn't look like he had this choice. Now, he said something in opening argument that the guy was going to testify, that Rudolph was going to testify. That's bold. I've never done that. You know, I always want to keep the option open. And I think he still could have kept the option open. Do I have time to tell a 45-second story about something another lawyer did, Drew Findling, or should we move on? There's a great lawyer. You might have heard about him, Drew Findling. And he had a trial about 4 years ago, 5 years ago, where his client shot her husband in the forehead. Like, that was it. And there was tons of experts, and each side, there's a lot of money at stake. So each side, the government hired a special prosecutor, and they brought in huge amounts of experts, tons. Blood splatter, brain splatter, history, psychology. Everybody had all their experts. And this special prosecutor had a really good idea. He didn't like that they go first and put on their case, and then the defense puts on a big case, and then they come on and try to clean up the small things. He had this, he thought, genius idea to just put on a small front case and then backload it. Keep all of the expert witnesses, everything to come on his rebuttal argument, and wow the jury and send them home. So he rested very early. And Drew had prepped everyone. He had this fantastic, you know, team ready to go. But he knew, nope, we're going to stop right here. We're going to forego all of that. We're ahead of the game. And he got up and he said, talked for a few minutes with the prosecutor, and said, nope, we're not putting on a case. Let's go. And he was ready to do closing argument. End result, two things happened. One, I've heard through the grapevine, not from Drew, that the client went home. She was acquitted, all counts. And the special prosecutor was apparently let go or not rehired. So you have the option mid-trial to change up your game plan. Now, did Marcus have that? We'll never know. I wasn't there. I don't know how much control the client had. But everything we've seen about this guy, his desire to be on TV, his desire to be controlling, seems like he's somebody who thought he could control a jury. And that seemed to be wrong.
Ian Wallach, we appreciate you taking the time. Thanks for coming on.
My pleasure. Be well.
Don't forget to listen, like, and subscribe to the Legal Face-Off podcast on social media and WGNradio.com. The novel Change Yourself is part of a larger part of the Paradigm Shift series. The book explores the evolving business of law as law firms and legal departments navigate rapid changes in the globalized business world, offering practical strategies for everyone from junior attorneys to experienced lawyers. Today, we are joined by friend of the show, Associate General Counsel for National Material LP, and now author David Sussler. David previously worked in private practice for 12 years, where he primarily focused on litigation. David, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
So this is big news, your first book. We've been covering and having you both on as part of your Inside Out series for many years. That's, in fact, how we met Tina many years ago. And that's a great column that the two of you put out together as both friend of the show and partner, husband of Tina Martini. Let's talk about your book. So the title is Change Yourself, part of the Paradigm Shift series. What is the genesis of this book? Tell us why you wrote it and what it's all about.
You want to go first, Tina, or you want me to?
Happy to kick it off. So thanks for having us on the show, Rich. So the genesis was that we've been doing this column in the Chicago Lawyer Magazine now, Inside Out, for 15 years. And there's something very, I guess, sobering about the 15-year mark, but also we've been hearing from many folks over the years how helpful they have found this column. And we realized that by hitting the 15-year threshold of talking about these topics, which really aren't cases, they're business of law topics, both managing oneself as well as managing the business of practicing law, whether it's an in-house environment or in private practice. And we realize that there's a whole generation of people, whether they're students or new lawyers or lawyers who've been practicing for a while, that haven't had the ability to sort of see and hear what we've been talking about for all these years. And so in the effort to really help people and to really celebrate the 15-year anniversary of our thought leadership together, we decided that it would be great to put everything into a book and to update it as needed.
Yeah. And I'll just add, these are really timeless topics that, some people call maybe the soft skills, but things like emotional intelligence, leadership, becoming a trusted advisor, professionalism, topics like that are really, they're helpful to, from law student to experienced lawyers at my stage of the career. And while it's written in the context of lawyers, it really is for everybody. The concepts span way beyond law, and really any professional, anybody who wants to improve their skills in life.
So I read some of it. It's excellent so far. And, it's your first book. So talk to me about the writing process. When did you have time, given that you're both incredibly busy, both inside a law firm or inside a business and as outside counsel? We're not used to necessarily writing in this style as lawyers. Was it difficult? Did you have writer's block? When did you find time? I'm sure once you start on some topics, it just flowed, and it was probably hard to even edit some of what you're saying. So talk to us about the process.
I'm happy to kick it off. So I have a couple of friends who are in-house attorneys who worked with a ghostwriter. I'm happy to do a shout out to Megs Thompson, who is our ghostwriter. And what she did was she worked with us to really get our arms around all the material that we had. We worked with her to bucketize them, and those buckets became chapters. And then she helped us weave together all of this thought leadership. Some of it was the stuff that David and I have written together. Some of it are things that I've written on my own. But she really helped us by starting the initial drafts of all of this material. Rich, I mean, as you know, we're all extraordinarily busy. I would have had writer's block and every other type of ailment when it came to actually putting pen to paper. But Megs really helped facilitate this process. And all in, it was less than 3 months from the time that we retained her to the time that we had the book on Amazon. David, did you want to add anything?
Yeah.
Than your average Alan Dershowitz book. We know, guests of the show will know that Alan Dershowitz has been on many times, and he pounds out books every few months. So that's Dershowitz speed.
Well, as I told people say, well, how long did it take you? And I say, well, it took us 15 years and it took us 3 months, because we've been writing these columns for 15 years, Inside Out and Paradigm Shift. We had a total of about 150 columns. And Meg's really helped us put them into prose. And Tina and I spent the majority of our nights and weekends, as well as our week-long staycation in early July, reading, editing, and revising. And you know, like you said, some of it was fairly easy, some of it was painful. But you know, we were really focused on keeping our voice because our columns are our voice, but they're columns, they're not prose. So Meg has really helped us transform it into a book. And I think she did a great job with our material.
Now let's make sure we're giving the proper credit. Meg or Megs?
Megs, M-E-G-S.
It's by Megs.
Were there more than one person named Meg who helped you?
No, her name is Megs, M-E-G-S, Megs. Okay. Megs Thompson.
Just the singular version, but sounds plural.
Yeah.
Well, you talk about in your book, changing yourself and changing your business. How are those two things different? And what advice does your book give on these two important fronts?
I mean, I'm happy to jump in here, David, to kick it off. So, you know, the whole concept of change yourself, change your business started when I started the Paradigm Shift podcast back in 2018. That was like my little slogan, if you will. And then we decided that when we were launching these books, that it made sense to use those to inform the names of our books. And our second book's coming out October 15th. And so the whole notion is, you know, as I said at the beginning of my preface, that nothing happens until something moves. The whole notion being that if you want to materially change what you're seeing in the world, what you're experiencing in the world, you have to make a positive forward movement on your own. You have to look within, be self-aware of things you do well, things you may not do so well. And once you create that forward momentum for yourself as a professional and an individual, you then are able to change the world around you, including the business that you either lead or that you partake in.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of people, and certainly Tina and I talk a lot about emotional intelligence as a critical element of success in the professional world. And really, pretty much everything we've written over the years is either explicitly or implicitly based in emotional intelligence. And so the book is really about developing your skills, trying to think about how do you become a better version of yourself in order to be a more successful lawyer, a more successful professional. And so the first book, when we bucketized these topics, we realized, well, there's a lot of things they're talking about improving you, yourself as an individual. And then the second book is talking about the organization. So now you have these skills. How do I implement them in the context of my business and to help improve my organization, my law firm, my company, my agency, whatever. So that's kind of what it's about.
Last question, Sus, we'll turn to you on this. Why are books, like why did you choose a book, right? We're in 2025, attention spans are probably shorter than ever. In many ways, to many people, the era of reading a book, especially one that is an actual living, breathing book with paper, is hard to conceptualize. You know, we're in the era of TikToks and Zooms and, you know, quick consumption of content. Why do you think a book, an actual book, is the proper method of delivering this content?
Because people do still read books, especially this type of book, and professionals who are interested in bettering themselves and succeeding in business do still read. And you don't have to read this in one sitting cover to cover. You can pick it up and put it down and read chapters here and there when you have time. And some of these chapters are 3-4 pages. There are a couple that are like 20 pages, but you can read it in small bites. And, you know, it's available in hardback, paperback, and ebook. And we have
potentially an audiobook.
Potentially audiobook. We're working on that. So
wherever finer books are sold, as they say. Tina, yes. We'll just end off with you. Despite what Susser just said, can you do some kind of TikTok video for us right now? Some kind of dance version of Paradigm Shift. Is that possible?
No.
I don't know. Here we go.
There you go. This. All right. I qualify.
There you go.
There it is.
There you go. It's show and tell, as I like to say.
Breaking the internet as we speak.
So, David Susser, thank you so much for coming on with us.
All right. Good to see you all again. Take care.
Where can everyone get the book?
Go get the book wherever books are sold.
I see it on Amazon. Where else?
Amazon, yeah,
Barnes and Noble,
and wherever else books are
sold. And your kitchen.
Yes.
Yes.
We have, they're available globally. That's another thing that Meg's helped us with is she also has she has her own publishing company. And so already seeing it in India and Europe. So all of our international listeners should be able to find it at a book provider, either online or in person near them. So thank you all for your support.
Congrats.
Thank you. See y'all later.
Rich Lenkoff is an attorney with Downey & Lenkoff, a firm with offices in Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin. Rich is consistently recognized by clients like McDonald's, Target, Macy's, Wendy's, and the Chicago Bears for his zealous advocacy and outstanding litigation results. Rich's many accolades include being named as an Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 to present and leading lawyer from 2012 to present. These are designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, serving on the Legal Prep Charter Academy Advisory Board and the Northern Illinois University College of Law Board of Visitors. Rich is also a producer with credits including 85, the greatest team in football history, starring Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka. Renegades, a Caesar's Palace production starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon, Rock of Ages, and Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel in concert. In addition to hosting WGN's Legal Face-Off since 2014, Rich serves as a legal analyst for a variety of media outlets. Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional malpractice, and intellectual property, among other practice areas. For more information about Rich and Downey & Lenkoff, please visit dl-firm.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off on WGN. It's time for the Legal Grab Bag. We are joined once again by Matt Liller, a partner at KPM Law, where he works on defending personal injury and premises liability cases, along with fraud and investigation matters. Thanks, Matt, for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Appreciate you coming on. Up next is Jennifer Cortez Johnson from Attruitt Law. Appreciate you taking the time, Jennifer. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me as well.
All right, we'll dive right in. French President Emmanuel Macron and his wife, Bridgette Macron, have sued the U.S. commentator Candace Owens over her baseless claim that Bridgette was born a man. And Rich, this conspiracy theory is now at the center of an international defamation legal battle.
Yeah, they're saying it's baseless. We don't usually start, Tina, with a French defamation lawsuit. It might be a first, but really interesting case. There is the couple in question. Of course, Macron is the leader of France. He is the French president. His wife, pictured here, or is she, Bridgette Macron, who is, usually they're well-known, Tina, for being a international May-December romance. I think she's 30 years older-ish than him. But this story emanates from a lawsuit that they brought, as Jack mentioned, for defamation against Candace Owens, who is I think it's fair to call her a right-wing podcaster. Most of her podcast is devoted to what I consider really fringe ideas and some theories, but she has a big following. And one of her stories is that Bridgette Macron, instead of being the wife and female wife of the leader of France, that she is actually a man, and he married a man. And this is a long-standing cover-up by the French president to, fool the public. Now, it should be noted that this is not a new theory that she came up with. Believe it or not, this theory has been litigated before. There was some French journalists who were sued by the Macrons also in 2024. They also were alleging the same thing, and that Bridgette Macron was someone named Jean-Michel Cognu. I'm French Canadian, so I could say it that way. Who is actually her brother-in-law? It's a sordid story. A court found those two guilty. The appellate court actually found them not guilty. They overturned the decision, not because they found that she was a man, but because the court there found that the plaintiffs didn't meet the standard of defamation. That case is on appeal. Kind of an interesting one, but what are your thoughts on this one?
Rich, I mean, you've really summarized it well. There's this notion of how difficult it is to prove defamation with obviously truth being a defense. With that issue of whether it's true or not, not necessarily being discussed front and center in terms of actually coming to the merits on that. I mean, from everything I've read on this, it sounds like a pretty ridiculous situation, what these allegations are by this podcaster. And to what end, right? I mean, you just have to ask yourself, to what end? I mean, this is just one piece of a bigger narrative of similar stories, not necessarily just about the Macrons, but about people who are, you know, who are in the United States too, who are famous politicians, that they're either dead and we're seeing body doubles or whatever the case may be. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see how this plays out, because I don't think the Macrons really have a choice but to take legal action here.
I think it's an exaggeration. This is Jennifer. I think that, honestly, it needs to be thrown out. They are public figures. I mean, stories are going to be made up of anyone who's a public figure. I think this is just a little ridiculous for them to bring this. They just got to be a little stronger, thicker skinned if they're going to be in politics. And it's really a ridiculous story. I mean, they don't have to prove that she's a female. They don't have to go. They don't have to do that.
Well, do you think it's ridiculous that they take on this lawsuit because of who they are and they have better things to do and they should leave this alone? Because if you take that argument, you apply the same standard to Trump, who's going after, you know, has gone after many media outlets, including now the Wall Street Journal, for publishing that story the book and the Epstein book. You apply the same standard there?
Well, I'm not going to talk about Trump. I'm going to talk about this case. But I think that they should, since they are public figures, I think that they have better things to do with their time than to fight these baseless stories. I mean, what are they going to bring up next? I mean, does she buy fake Dior bags or anything like that? I mean, is that bag, Dior bag, an actual Dior bag, or is that a fake one?
Yeah. You know? I mean, Matt, where do you draw the line? I mean, again, to Jennifer's point, this is the leader of one of the, you know, biggest and most prosperous countries on the planet. Should he be taking every conspiracy theorist and podcaster to court? Don't they have better things to do with their time, or is this valid?
And I think that's the big point, is where is the line? Because when you're a public figure and going up the chain and being, you know, a spouse of one of the world leaders is almost as high as a public figure as one can get. The more you're a public figure, the more of the, you know, the cockamamie made up things that are going to be said, the conspiracy theories, and you kind of have to expect it, I think, when you get to a certain light of that level of celebrity and well-knownity. And so I do think this one falls into the camp of you probably have better things to do, particularly that because it's been out there. It's not like even if there's some degree of success with this particular lawsuit, this thought has been in society for so long, it's unlikely that it will never see the light of day again, regardless of this lawsuit's outcome.
Yeah, I mean, you could pull up, like, just yesterday I was looking at the video of Tim Cook, who's the leader of Apple, at the White House, right? And, you know, I like to read comments just because they're funny. And I mean, there was, I don't know, hundreds and hundreds of comments talking about Trump and Cook, and most of them were negative. I mean, what, are you going to sue all those people? I mean, that, to Jennifer's point, that's the world. People have comments and, like, deal with it, right? You can't bring a lawsuit every time you're upset with some nonsensical allegation online.
Yeah, agreed. 100%. They chose, and it's a life that they chose. So this is something that you're just going to have to roll with the punches. I mean, you're going to be talked about all the time. And it's better to be talked about something, a ridiculous story like this, rather than the politics. Wasn't this the same, the person who was actually, didn't they have footage of her hitting him as he's exiting a plane? Okay.
The second most famous video is them before they step out of the plane. She clearly hits him, and then he, you know, tries to pretend like nothing happened.
Right.
Those French.
Moving along, law firm Duane Morris firm has been sued. Tina, what's more on that?
Yeah, Jack. So a Black partner at the law firm Duane Morris, her name is Megan Garland, has filed a lawsuit against the firm, alleging that it's engaging in a misclassification scheme by requiring non-equity partners to pay various types of expenses, including business expenses and partnership taxes, even though their compensation doesn't float with the performance of the firm and they don't have voting power. There were quite a few allegations in this complaint, but, you know, the gist is that she claims that after her promotion, the firm stopped withholding employment taxes from her compensation, and began assessing her a share of the firm's partnership taxes, which is usually something you only see when you're an equity partner. They also started asking non-equity partners, including her, to supply their own computers, internet, and office supplies. She claims that she was also being paid less than white and male lawyers, and that the firm had failed to provide pay information in violation of California law. And that she also says that she didn't even know what the deductions to her pay were going to be until after she accepted the non-equity partner position. So last week, a federal court judge allowed several of these claims to proceed. She also tossed out a few claims and has left Garland. She's allowed her to amend two of the claims. Rich, we're seeing more and more of these types of lawsuits. You know, this one is interesting because a lot of firms have the non-equity equity partner structure. You know, I don't know what you think, but I mean, I've just seen this structure for so many years in big law, and I very rarely see challenges like this to that kind of structure.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I guess one of the reasons it's so potentially groundbreaking is it could open the veil. That's the right term. Open the veil? No. Lower the veil? Who knows? It could show us more information about big law and some of these firms that they obviously want to produce. I mean, a lot of law firms are famously non-transparent, even though they, you know, say they are, about some of the internal goings on, and especially when it comes to compensation, right? And if this lawsuit proceeds, which the court seems to be bending over backwards to let it proceed, this might lead to more transparency than ever before when it comes to how attorneys are compensated. And as we know, especially at big law, once one firm does something, the rest follows suit. So I'm interested in seeing how this plays out there. And, you know, this notion that law firms are going to charge you out more for your hourly rate as a partner, which is true, which is one of the advantages of becoming partner, both for the firm and the attorney, but maybe not pay you, you know, commensurate with that is interesting. So I think it has some legs. I'm interested to see how it goes. Matt, what are your thoughts on this?
So I think this has some legs depending on the, you know, the specific details as far as, you know, what is transparent to the employees and to the partners as they're being promoted. I've worked at two different law firms that have the, you know, the middle level, partner level, the income partner level. It's my rudimentary understanding that at some of the big law firms, that's kind of a thing where I think it's like a K-1 tax form. I'm not a tax attorney, but I think that's kind of a thing where the situation described in this lawsuit is a known thing where I think the payroll taxes and whatnot are a little bit more on the employee than the firm. But you know, as the articles are written, I haven't looked at the complaint, but I think it has legs and it could potentially be groundbreaking for a lot of big law firms on how their compensation is structured.
Jennifer, what are your thoughts?
I agree 100%. I think that it does have legs. I think that the partners in that law firm that are doing those things to the income partners is incorrect. They are, even though they're called income partners, I mean, it clearly is. They're clearly employees. If they're fired at will, and they should get all the benefits that the employees get. I think that there's certainly legs on this lawsuit.
All right, moving along here. A group of 9 current and former students in Kansas has filed a federal civil rights lawsuit claiming that their school district illegally used AI power surveillance to monitor their technology use. They argue this violated their rights. Rich, do you agree?
Well, first of all, it's called Gaggle. I've never heard of this, but it's an AI tool that sifts through anything connected to Google Workshop, which, you know, schools use all the time. This includes things, you know, like Gmail, Drive, and other products. And, you know, they say the intent is to flag that content for things like, you know, any references to self-harm, depression. You know, they'll tag things like calling her A or my mental health, which, you know, seems like an admirable goal. But the flip side of that and using technology and especially AI is that what else does it have access to, right? It has access to all of the communication that these students are engaged in. And where does it stop? So I think there is some merit to the idea that these students' privacy is being violated by the school's use of it. They are asserting, the school's asserting that you know, it's all for the kid's benefit. So that's admirable too. That's something we want as a father. You know, I want that too, but that's a slippery slope. And I think it's something that we're all dealing with as we're using AI. AI is incredible, but there are some downsides to it. And this lawsuit, I think, points out some of those potential dangers.
I agree, Rich, completely. I think we've learned, and as we've seen with many of the stories that we've covered here on Legal Face-Off involving AI, whether it's in the courtroom or outside the courtroom, that there's just a real need for guardrails on it. And I think as the technology continues to advance, we just need to be very mindful of the slippery slopes that we're facing here. I do think that this has legs in terms of the potential rights violations here.
Yeah, I mean, one of the other allegations is that this is not only for the content that we describe, but also for some student journalism, right? That's being intercepted before publication, that's being flagged. So that, again, might be dangerous.
I think for the greater good, I think it's important to keep it. I understand the slippery slope when you're talking about what else they can get to, but the greater good is the protection of the kids. And at the end of the day, we failed on a lot of different school shootings. We failed to recognize or see things that we could have done, and this could have prevented some of these things. So, I tell my kids, you have no rights. I mean, you're under 18. I'm sorry, you have no rights. I'm going to control everything. I'm going to make sure because I know better. That's my personal position on it. I think that, yeah, I mean, you can probably find out things that you're not supposed to find out. And there is a slippery slope, but for the greater good and the protection of our children, I'm 100% behind it.
Well, Matt, that's an interesting point because legally, what Jennifer is saying is that you have no rights as a student, which I get. And that's sort of been, you know, the analogous situation is lockers, right? For years, there's been lawsuits over whether a school could go into someone's locker to check out what's going on in there to find drugs or weapons. You know, courts have consistently held that that's school property and the schools have a right to do that. Is this the same situation? Is this content the same as the school going into a locker and therefore the students have no right to privacy?
That's how I see it. And I don't think that it's, I think it's also tremendously analogous to work and what your reasonable expectation of privacy is as to work communications. You know, if I send an email from my work email address, I have no expectation of privacy. I think anybody from the firm's administrator, IT department, whatever can see it. If I'm saving emails, if I'm, you know, anywhere in the cloud usage of my firm's software, if I do a Google search on my work computer, you know, I don't think I have a reasonable expectation of privacy that my employer cannot know what I've searched on the browser, on their computer, you know, in their cloud system. And I think kind of going off of the assumption that the Google Drive / Gaggle in this article is kind of a school use system, that Google Drive is used for, you know, for school purposes, I fall on the camp of students shouldn't have a reasonable expectation of digital privacy on communication sent or received within the school server.
Right, moving along. Denise Richards says ex Aaron Pipers stole her laptop and leaked private photos of her without consent. Tina, she says this violated a restraining order and escalated their messy divorce.
Jack, so scrolling back a little bit, as recently as this past March, Denise Richards had said she would never get divorced again. And as we all know, she had a highly public split from Charlie Sheen a number of years ago, which she said pretty recently she thinks torpedoed her career. 6 years ago, she remarried. She married Aaron Pipers. And unfortunately, last month, that marriage hit the skids when he filed for divorce right after the 4th of July, citing irreconcilable differences. This marriage also was pretty troubled, it seems, right from the start, including allegations of domestic violence and financial issues. Days after the filing, Richards was granted a temporary restraining order against her soon-to-be ex-husband, alleging a pattern of physical abuse throughout their marriage. There have been a lot of media outlets who have displayed some pretty disturbing images of what she claims were him beating her, including to the face, choking, slapping, and threatening to kill her, along with threats to kill himself as well. He's vehemently denied all these allegations. As Jack mentioned in the most recent of headlines, She's claiming now that Vipers has violated her restraining order against him and stolen her laptop, which apparently includes nude photos, and that there's allegations that he has sent her private information to the media from her laptop directly, including text messages and naked pictures. She's asked the judge to order him to return the laptop and all of its pictures and recordings, along with any cell phones and other technology that he may still have of hers. A full hearing is actually happening on the restraining order tomorrow to determine if this TRO against him will become permanent. Yeah, Rich, this is just another ugly divorce, unfortunately, for Denise Richards.
Yeah, I mean, this is precisely why I stopped sending naked pictures of myself all around. You know, I mean, listen, no one condones cyberbullying, or I mean, this is a serious issue that people are engaged in, and most generally men against women. But, you know, again, most of it could be solved by having some discretion and not putting yourself in that situation. Not to blame the victim at all, of course, but, you know, this is completely abhorrent behavior, if true. But again, you know, it's probably not wise these days with everyone having access to as much information as we have to even put yourself in that situation. But yeah, I mean, hopefully this will be resolved legally. Jennifer, what's your take on this?
Well, two things. I think, you know, this is in California. I know they have revenge porn law in California, so he can't disseminate any pictures of her because that's criminally prosecuted. He could serve jail time on that and in addition to a hefty fine. And the other thing is that this is her intellectual property because as far as I know, what I follow on this is that she's on OnlyFans and this is part of her work, her nude photographs that she sells. So I think that's considered an intellectual property and that's protected. So that's something else that they should bear in mind. So I think that at the end of the day, he's going to have to return all those and he's going to be prohibited from distributing it anyway, either through the revenge porn law or violation of or any type of copyright infringement.
Right. Next up, we have Alan Dershowitz claiming he's suing pierogi vendors at Martha's Vineyard who allegedly refused his service over political views. Passerbyers posted videos of the police telling Dershowitz to stop harassing the vendors. Rich, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I mean, you know, we've had Dershowitz on many times. It has been a couple of years, but he's been a frequent guest of our show. I didn't think I'd be covering a story involving him and, you know, Polish delicacies, Tina, but you know, it continues to be in the news. You know, he has been all over the news lately because of his involvement in the Epstein case. And he is alleging that the pierogi vendor is alleging that they refused service to him because of his past with Epstein, with other, with representing what they say are perpetrators of sexual abuse. He says he was denied pierogi in Martha's Vineyard by good pierogi, not because of any legal reasoning, but because he's Jewish. He's claimed anti-Semitism. Ironically, or maybe to the point, the vendor identifies as Jewish as well and, you know, denies that that was a reason for denying service, Tina, that it was simply based on their disagreement with him and his political and legal stances. You know, we have covered extensively the rights of vendors to refuse service to people they don't agree with. Generally, the Supreme Court has found that to be legal behavior as long as it's part of a religious, you know, reason and not a discriminatory reason. I don't want to get into that whole discussion, but yeah, pierogi, and maybe he could shop elsewhere for pierogi, or maybe like an empanada or gnocchi or some other ethnic encompassed product.
I mean, this is... like, I mean, this is just so reminiscent of that Seinfeld episode, No Soup for You. And, you know, this is just part of the bigger narrative, right? I mean, we love Dersh because he's been on the show for many years. But, you know, this is part of his, what, 5-year, 7-year narrative now that he's created, that he's been canceled on Martha's Vineyard because of his political views, et cetera. And so I don't think we could go and a whole summer season without hearing from Dersh in some shape or form about some type of slight that he has encountered, whether it's the public library or the local pierogi guy, because he's been canceled for various reasons.
Matt, you're a guy who loves pierogi. Would you be offended by being refused this product?
Probably, but I think this actually is an interesting loop all the way back to the very first topic of French President Macron and his alleged wife, as far as, you know, getting a certain level of notoriety and celebrity and public figureness. You typically don't get there without rubbing somebody the wrong way somewhere along the line. And so, you know, this may be a situation of, you know, Mr. Dershowitz has risen to a level of fame given his particular, you know, beliefs and actions, and it rubbed somebody the wrong way somewhere along the line. And this was the retaliation in the end game was no pierogi for you.
Jack, here's what we should do. We should invite Dersh to Pierogi Fest, which not many people know is up here in Northwest Indiana, not too far, right? Have you covered Pierogi Fest? I'm sure you've covered that.
I have not. I wish I did, but I haven't gotten that assignment yet.
Delicious.
All right, next up. During a New York State bar exam, allegedly a test taker suffered cardiac arrest, and there's fallout from it. Tina, what is going on with this?
So, Jack, last week was a lot of law school graduates across the country were taking the bar. A lot of us know people who were, and very quickly, we were all receiving word that it was out of the Hofstra location that a Fordham graduate had fallen to the floor unconscious during the morning session and was actually in full cardiac arrest. The good news is that she survived the incident. The horrible news coming out of this is the reports that the proctors of the exam refused to stop the exam during the medical emergency and that they were allegedly slow to get medical help. And that it actually took a number of the bar exam takers who were told to continue to take the exam, by the way, and they were instructed specifically not to stop taking the exam. Some of these bar exam takers were begging the proctors to get medical help so that this woman could be assisted. I mean, and the story just gets worse and worse, Rich. Apparently, there were security officers that finally arrived to the room with equipment and were performing chest compressions, all while the test takers continued to take the exam just a few feet away from where the woman was in cardiac arrest. One witness reported that the proctors actually waited until the lunch break to let the paramedics come in, which is when the test takers were allowed to leave. Above the Law is one of the media outlets that covered the story and had actually called the Bar of Law Examiners seeking a statement after the story broke. And these calls went unanswered because apparently they were out of the office for the rest of the week after the bar exam. The board eventually did make a statement claiming that the priority was the candidate and not the exam. And they also said that the tests were quickly collected and the candidates were dismissed for lunch. But eyewitnesses, many of whom said they are worried about retribution and are remaining anonymous, said, Rich, that this story was just not true.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of different parts of the story. I mean, number one, is the collapse accurate? There's always some. Seems like every year there's a faker at these exams in every city who is trying to game the system and get extra time or get a computer or whatever the advantage is. And then, you know, the reaction by the proctors is problematic. And then, you know, the question of whether they should be allowed to retake the bar. I mean, I usually don't feel too bad for people complaining, but I do think, Jennifer, there's some argument that it's hard to focus on the most important exam of your life when in one case, this was happening right inches from the test taker and all this commotion. I mean, I would think that would throw you off your ability to focus on this exam.
Absolutely. I think that they did wrong. I think that they should have at least called off. I don't know how the bar works over there, but I think it's in different sections. That at least that section of the bar should have been called off or postponed and given everyone the opportunity to restart that section. I mean, I don't think that's asking for too much. And, you know, the way they handle this and addressed and not even address the person in distress right away while she's on the floor and telling people to continue with your exam. I mean, that's horrible. I mean, I probably, if I was in that situation, I would have thrown my hands up and said, I'll go help you. Screw the bar exam. I mean, I don't care. Someone's obviously dying over here. Right. So I can't even imagine that situation. But yeah, it sucks for the test takers as well, because it is distracting, and that could have definitely impaired their ability to answer the questions for that particular section of the bar.
And Matt, those are all great points. Matt, how do you not plan for this, right? How do you not anticipate that there might be a medical emergency during this very stressful exam with hundreds or thousands of people in the room, and have a immediate response ready, right? I mean, this can't be news to the exam company or the security.
Yeah, and I think it you know, the A+ answer is to have some type of emergency response plan in play, and also kind of have the plan in play of, you know, there's got to be some type of review, administrative review as far as what the incident was. Do these test takers need to get a second chance at retaking the portion of the exam that they were taking at this time, and kind of having that? I mean, let's not forget we're all humans, and, you know, a bar exam is a bar exam. I was talking about this earlier this week with one of my colleagues who said actually something tremendously similar happened to her when she took the bar exam. A person a few tables away had a seizure and collapsed to the floor, and one of the people nearby had some medical training and you know, left their seat and assisted the person having a seizure. But it took 10 or 15 minutes for emergency personnel to get there. And, you know, people were still typing away, and the test takers are caught in this limbo of, you know, oh my gosh, do I help this person, or oh my gosh, do I have to finish my test? Because if I don't pass the bar exam, I've got some tremendous problems. And you know, the good Samaritan test taker, I don't think was given any additional time to make up, you know, for the time they were rendering aid. And so, you know, I think the bigger takeaway is, you know, these states and bar examiners having some type of plan in place for if any type of event happens. And actually, I'm in Virginia. We actually have a new associate here that just took the bar exam a couple of days ago, and he said that the fire alarm was going off in one of the rooms where test takers were taking the test. And, you know, once it was determined that there was no emergency, everybody was told to keep taking the exam. And so I think planning ahead is probably the way to go.
All right, last one in this week's legal grab bag. A Chuck E. Cheese employee in Florida was arrested for using a customer's credit card without permission to make multiple purchases. And Rich, he was dressed in the costume and arrested in front of the kids.
It's about time we put this criminal enterprise to bed. You know, these Chuck E. Cheese. I wanted to put many Chuck E. Cheese guys in handcuffs, and finally in Tallahassee it was done. Yeah, Tina, here, this employee allegedly had stolen a credit card, had used it. The cops found out that he was working. They found the credit card on him, actually. And instead of going quietly, because they wanted to arrest him in the parking lot, I guess, rather than on the premises, he resisted. So what choice did the coppers have but to cuff this large rodent and take him away? And much to the chagrin of the kids, probably, you don't see this image too much, but... you know, you do the, I'm trying to think of a good pun here, but you do the crime, you got to do the time, even if you're Chuck E. Cheese.
Yeah, I mean, it was really kind of nuts, this whole thing that, you know, stealing a credit card, claiming he didn't use it, but there were receipts laying around that showed, you know, that he actually did use it. I mean, you know, doing this in costume, I mean, it's just the whole thing. I think the moral of this story is if you're going to be a criminal, be a little smarter about it.
Yeah, 100%. Matt, Jennifer, any PTSD lawsuits in the future for some of these kids who were trying to enjoy their afternoon and instead saw their hero being cuffed and perp walked?
I would just love to see the mugshot and see if he had any makeup or anything trying to identify more as a rodent once he took that costume off. But I'm not a big fan of Chuck E. Cheese, so I'm happy to see him walk away in cuffs. He's a little scary.
Man, whoever's responsible for cleaning that ball pit, I think, should be cuffed.
Exactly.
Yeah, and we can remember, you know, pictures of Mr. Charles Entertainment Cheese from a couple decades ago where he looked even rougher around the edges. So I guess it's no surprise that he's succumbed to felonious acts.
All right, well, let's end off by talking about some other maybe mascots or characters that maybe we wouldn't mind seeing cuffed and perp walked out of their establishment. Let's go to you, Jack. If you had to pick one character, fictional, I guess, like a Chuck E. Cheese, to be cuffed and walked out, who would that be?
That's a fun question. I'm going to move over into the sports world a little more comfortable. I'm trying to remember the guy's name. The Flyers mascot, he's just scary. I'm trying to remember his name. I could look it up, but he's always doing something. Another one would, I think another one that might be better is the Braves mascot Blooper. If you look at his Twitter account, he's always trying to stir the pot with people and talking trash. So if he got arrested, I think that'd be a big karma for him coming back at him.
Yeah, you're talking about Gritty as the Flyers mascot.
That one, yeah.
He looks perpetually drunk. He's got those googly
eyes. Yes.
He probably is drunk most of the time, so that's probably a good move. Matt Liller, mascot or character would you want to see perp walk the hell out of there?
The Kool-Aid man for all that property damage.
Oh, damn.
I like the Kool-Aid guy.
Good, man. Totally disregarding property rights, busting through walls, doesn't care. Imagine the damage he's doing to establishments by busting through those walls all the time. Mm-hmm. I like that call. By the way, also a star of the HBO series, The Studio, Kool-Aid Man. Do you know that? Have you seen The Studio? Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's in that.
No.
All right, Jennifer, who would you like to be? Who would you like to see in cuffs?
Hands down, Barney, but I don't know that they can get the cuffs on him. I think they'd have to put them in front.
Barney is terrifying.
Yeah.
That's a good one. Let's see, Tina.
None come to mind. I'm going to have to noodle on it. As boring as that is, Rich, I am speechless.
We stumped you with this one. How about Lisa? What do you got?
Clowns are the worst, I think.
Clowns, yeah, that's a good one. My go-to mascot coming up was a guy named Yuppie, who is the mascot of the Expos, and now he is the mascot of the Montreal Canadiens. And again, like, who knows what he is, what he's doing, you know, what's going on with, he's just a big orange thing. It's very unclear. So I would arrest him for the simple reason of interrogating him and finding out, you know, what he is and what he's all about.
What about the Pillsbury Doughboy?
Oh, hell yeah. Just for me, you know, maybe prison will get him in shape, you know, maybe he'll be able to lose that doughboy body and stop being touched by
and that giggle.
Yeah, I mean, he's being violated all the time by being touched in his belly. Maybe prison will harden him up a little, you know, drop a few pounds.
All right, that'll do it for the Legal Greg Bag. Jennifer and Matt, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that will do it for the latest installment of the Legal Face-Off on WGN. Special thanks to David Sussler, Associate General Counsel for National Material LP and co-author of Change Yourself, David Super, Professor of Law and Economics at Georgetown, and Ian Wallach, a trial attorney at the Law Office of Ian Wallach. Shout outs to Ben Anderson, Lisa Stagel, and Ryan Burrell. For Tina Martini, Rich Lenkoff, I'm Jack Heinrich. Thanks again for tuning in to Legal Face-Off on WGN.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Lenkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face-Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget.